first minute or two, the sound is a little raw, but it gets cleared up real fast. So don't worry about the initial sound quality. John Steele, On Memory, KPFK Los Angeles.
Okay, we have ignition. This morning, we're going to explore a vast array of stuff which has come to me over the years through various channels with no names. And I'm really going to speak my mind. I'm going to think it out so it's not in any set form. But there is an order I want to go through. And it will be kind of a look at different elements of contracted mind and extended mind, so we can begin to see the juxtaposition of the two, how each one defines the other. The element of contracted mind I'd like to look at first, before the extended mind aspect. And for those of you who heard me last year, I'll briefly capitulate this idea of the Kali Yuga as a set piece before I launch into the specifics. The Kali Yuga is the age that we live in terms of East Indian chronology. There are four great yugas of time. There is, roughly speaking, a golden age, a Sat Yuga, and then a silver age, and then a bronze age, and then an iron age, each one of varying durations. We won't get into the cosmological mathematics because they're up for grabs. Allegedly, the age that we live in now is the end of a cycle. Each of these four ages is part of a cycle called a Mahayuga. The Kali Yuga is the dark age, it's the iron age, it's the age of Kali. Kali is a goddess of dissolution of time and structures. She clears the way for those impediments of evolution that have arisen. Now, in the Kali Yuga, what occurs is, in terms of time, very interesting, because the Tibetan translation for Kali Yuga literally means the dregs of time. The dregs of time, what does that mean? It means the bottom of the barrel of time. It means that time has reached a density, a certain temporal density. And this temporal density can actually be felt somatically in the body. Now, what is the definition of temporal density? Temporal density means we have too many events per unit of time to fully assimilate in our everyday life. That means that you've got to pay the bills and take the kids out and go to the doctor and wash the clothes and put out the cat and, you know, do everything. It's an unending array of tasks that have to be accomplished. And just when you think you've finished them all, new ones magically arise. You are never finished. Now, so the Kali Yuga has this idea of a temporal density, and I want to explore that in several different ways here. One of the things that occurs in the Kali Yuga, one other aspect, which is an interesting concomitant to the temporal density, is that there is a seasonal disequilibrium. In other words, the climate and the seasons go out of whack. Rain doesn't fall at the right time. Snow doesn't fall at the right time. There's a seasonal imbalance. This is one of the aspects in terms of the Kali Yuga, this climatic disequilibrium. And what I'm pointing to is when you get a temporal disequilibrium, you know, high temporal density, there is at least a correspondence to a climatic fluctuation. And as people like Padmasambhava and other great teachers have said, this climatic disequilibrium is part of the Kali Yuga. Now, one of the aspects in terms of, again, of Eastern thought that occurs in the Kali Yuga our time window narrows in this kind of density scenario. And so what happens, last night the Miller Lite beer ad was mentioned. I will mention another beer ad which may bring back some memories. Quite a few years ago in America there was a Schlitz ad, Schlitz beer of Milwaukee. And it showed these macho guys on the sailboat and the spray coming out. And it said, you only go around once in life, so grab all the gusto you can. So the idea was, since, you know, this was it, you had to have as good a time as possible right now. So the idea encapsulated in this ad is many different values. First of all is the idea that there are no past lives and there are no future lives. This is it. And therefore, you've got to hedonistically explode in the moment and just really grab everything possible. Now, the value inherent here is that you'll go for short-term games and to hell with anything possible long-term. So this means rip off anyone, have war, as long as you profit in the immediate moment, grab all the gusto you can. Now, back to Buddhism for a moment. In the one of the sutras, the La Kavantara Sutra, one of the Buddhist sutras, there is a wonderful teaching, and this is not Tantric Buddhism, it's Mahayana Buddhism, but it's still the same basic set. And one of the teachings in there goes as such, for those of you who, my work is on memory, so I have this great interest in the subject. It says, when the triple world is surveyed, that's past, present, future, by the Bodhisattva, he perceives that its existence is due to memory that has been accumulated since the beginningless past, but wrongly interpreted. Now, it is this concept of memory that is wrongly interpreted that I want to take a good hard look at here. And before we get into that, a few more notes. The word memory in Sanskrit comes from the word vasana, V-A-S-A-N-A, and it's a beautiful word because it has several different nuances. It means a memory which is transmitted from one life to another, either consciously or unconsciously, usually unconsciously. Memories, habit patterns that are generated within one life are called samskaras. That's different from a vasana. Vasanas have a cross-life connection. Now, one of the secondary meanings of this word vasana is very appropriate to one of my other interests, and that is fragrance, because the secondary meaning of the word vasana means if you have an empty perfume bottle, even if it's completely empty, the smell always remains of that scent in that bottle. In other words, the scent pervades even when the vessel is empty, and this is what in the Sanskrit language, very mixture of great technical precision and great poetic insight. You have this idea that a past life memory is like it's like the smell which goes through time. The smell memory goes from one life to another, even though the bottle is empty. Now, in this word also means habit energy. Vasana means habit energy, and this word habit energy in Tibetan, bachag, is the term for it. It's like a trace, like the smell, like the trace. And the teaching in the sutra is that these traces, they build up after a while to the extent where we begin to nucleate an ego around them, like I get up every morning and I do this and I eat that. And you get this whole kind of an axis of a moment, what the Buddhists call an axis of the moment, begins to generate. This I, the subject, begins to generate from habitual action, repetitive, automatic, hypnotic, action. Now, therefore, one of the strategies to deal with this nucleation around this moment of subjectivity is to learn how to, shall we say, die to oneself. And this is in the perennial philosophy, in the mystical philosophies, known as the tradition of unknowing, like the 14th century English mystic work, The Cloud of Unknowing. And this whole process I want to look at in a moment. I just wanted to set that out. Now, With the idea of memory wrongly interpreted, we can begin to look at a bit of present time through this filter. You see, we live in an age at which we are virtually hoarding memory. Computers are based on the idea of, like, you look at women in terms of their vital measurements. Well, you look at computers in terms of their vital measurements in terms of their memory capacities. This one has so many bits, and this one has more bits, and this one can process those bits faster and faster. The memorial capacity is really the key to the strength of a computer. Now, the trouble is with this is that I'm generalizing. Much of what computers do is wonderful. I'm not putting down computers per se. But there is an emphasis on the acquisition of memories that can be stuck into the computer. And what too many memories do after a while, whether they are in a... See, because if they're in a computer, even if they're in a computer, they have to be in a programmer's mind, even in a real chunked style. They have to be some level of recursiveness in the even in the programmer's mind. Now, how much he offloads into the computer itself, there has to be some level of memory of what's inside. So the more that's inside the computer, the more that has to be in the mind of the programmer. It's a great reduction, but still, you begin to set up a great array of memories that is auxiliary to what would be needed for ordinary life. Now, what begins to happen is that with this tremendous array of memory storage, and you begin to clog a system. A system becomes constipated by actual too much hoarding of memory. Now, this hoarding of memory sets up a kind of a psychological density. And as a system becomes clogged, it becomes brittle. That is to say, it cannot react quickly to crisis situations because it is overloaded with choices and information. There's too much information. Every time that something happens now in the modern world, the reaction time is stunted to such a point by the vast array of information processing technology that people cannot react like that anymore in real critical decisions. Everything is so rationally displayed in terms of its memorial capacity. And yet, with all this memorial capacity and all this incredible telecommunications, the world is coming apart at the seams. I mean, we're balanced on, as the Tibetans say, we're licking honey from the razor's edge in terms of our information acquisition. It's actually, and this is memory wrongly interpreted, this vast collection of memory as though more is better. That's the assumption that we're working under. Now, the more memory that you accrete, you see, paradoxically, you set yourself up more for what in systems terms we call the likelihood of a runaway system. A runaway system is like a snowball going down a hill, getting bigger and bigger and more progressively out of control. And the more you develop memory wrongly interpreted in terms of vast acquisition, the more likely you are to go into a runaway system. Because your reaction time is cut. Your direct perception, your direct, unmediated by vast information technology is cut. And this likelihood of a runaway system occurs. And this is what happens, you see, in things like all this Contragate stuff. You have this incredible information technology. You have the NSC computers and the CIA computers and the DIA computers and all these things. And what happens is that you lose control of who's in charge. It's Ollie North is running the ball this way and Colby is running the ball this way, and everyone's kind of what we call in systems theories again. You begin to generate institutions within institutions. And this happens when you get this memory wrongly interpreted to such a point where clarity disappears of the overview. Now, what further begins to happen is that this memory wrongly interpreted begins to generate... There are two types of unconscious mind I want to point out here. One is what I would call unconscious. And that's when you're asleep at the wheel. It's like you're dead drunk. It's like you're numbed. There's no sensation. Okay. That's unconscious, unconscious. Then, contrasted to that, there's conscious, unconscious. Now, the link of conscious, unconscious is really shamanic consciousness. It's where there is a bridge between the conscious mind and the unconscious mind. It's what Jung would call the transcendent function. There's a bridge between these two realms. Now, most people are walking around, as all the perennial philosophies say, we're in a state of sleep. We're walking around in a state of unconscious, unconscious. It's what Gurdjieff calls, we're all asleep. We're sleepwalkers. This unconscious, what happens then is this: there's an unconscious mental mass is generated by memory wrongly interpreted. In other words, what begins to happen is, conversely to what Terence was talking about last night, the idea of a living conscious memory, what gets generated is what William Burroughs would call language as virus is generated. You see, this is where language goes out of control. It's just the opposite to a living language. And what is what I call an unconscious mental mass proliferates in the environment. And it means that there's all these kind of invisible habit patterns and invisible kind of runaway systems linguistically on a subvocal voice in the environment. And one of my teachers has said that at a certain point, habit patterns become solidified in the environment and in the body. Now, this is something that, and this is from the Tibetan point of view, this is something actually that Norbu said, that habit patterns get solidified, and the great illustration of this in terms of, for example, in tantric thought, is there's a great Indian Mahasiddha, Saraha, who was the arrow maker, and he taught the idea that memory, it can exist in many states. It's like water. Water can be very fluid, and that at a certain point it can become ice. It becomes solidified. Now, that's the shift from natural mind and natural memory to memory wrongly interpreted when it solidifies. And when it solidifies, the mind stops. It gels like that. And that's where this sensation of ego comes from, this nucleation. So this idea of an unconscious mental mass as the idea of language as virus is something that we kind of have to be aware of. It's the idea that words have a life of their own. It's like people's minds, the subvocal voice. Oftentimes you think, well, I'm in charge, and the subvocal voice is going, I want this, I want this, I want this, what the Buddhists call monkey mind. It's like it's going here and here and here, and you are saying, I don't really think that, but something else, this automatic mind is going off, and that's this language as virus, memory wrongly interpreted, gone organic. Now, one of the aspects of why that there's this great accumulation of memory is it's the idea, the illusion is that the more memory we have, the more control and manipulation and prediction of reality we will have. If we can manage memory and keep it, you know, on tap so we can push a button, therefore we'd be able to manipulate reality better with all this memory that we've got there, and the external forms of computer banks and books and everything else. And we begin to hoard memory because we feel it will give us prediction and control and manipulation of reality. The Central Intelligence Agency, stop and think of that for a moment. Central Intelligence Agency, what does it do? It gathers information about everything in the world except the natural intelligence of the people who are in the organization. There's nothing to do with self-knowledge. Intelligence of the other, not of self-knowledge. Now, the idea of this memory wrongly interpreted brings us to an interesting model here. Again, in the Buddhist framework, We talk about that thought or memory, as the teaching goes, as Saraha teaches in his what he calls the royal song, the Dohas. And these are kind of like poetic teachings. He teaches that memory arises from emptiness, abides in emptiness, and then dissolves back into emptiness. Or, as he teaches, memory arises from non-memory, what he calls non-memory, abides in non-memory, and then sinks back, dissolves into non-memory. Now, this cycle of arising, abiding, and dissolving is the cycle of all thought. And this cycle is also two other analogs that we can give to it. It is the basic nature of today what Prigogine calls dissipative systems. Things arise, they abide, and they dissolve. And they arise in a slightly different form, and then they abide in a slightly different form, and they dissolve. Now, dissipative systems, a footnote on this, is much more ancient than Prigogine. What all he's done is brought it into a contemporary mode. In the early forms of my interest of archaeology, we find it embodied in the idea of the triple goddess. That is to say, the triple goddess is exemplified by the three phases of the moon. And that is to say, there's a new moon, there's a full moon, and then there's the waning moon. And then they go back to a fourth phase, which people rarely really recognize, and that is the state where moon is not visible at all. That is really the true emptiness. And this dissipative cycle is mirrored in the arising of thought, abiding of thought, and dissolving back into. Now, well, the reason I bring this up is the following, is that in the paradigm of memory, as it's looked at in the 20th century, memory is looked at primarily from the point of view of Western psychology only in one of these three phases. That is to say, it's looked at principally in the middle phase, the abiding phase. We do not look at where memory comes from or where it goes to. Only in a psychoanalytical sense, we look at your childhood memories and stuff like that. But we do not really consider the idea of emptiness or of non-memory as an origin point. We look at this kind of psychoanalytic history as our way, but not as real emptiness. So we have a focus only on one phase, the abiding phase, that is the phase of how do memories operate in the ordinary, everyday, visible world. How do we operate in that form? And this is where memory, wrongly interpreted, generates itself and proliferates, right in this gap of only looking at the middle phase of the dissipative cycle. Because you neglect the arising and dissolving, you begin to get an overbalance, and that's why it gets brittle. That's why it gets constipated, because the cycle is looked at in only one part of it. Okay, now the next thing that I would like to look at is the idea that one of the characteristics of the Kali Yuga, another one besides this temporal density, is the whole concept, and this is something I've been developing for my doctoral thesis for years, but it progressively comes into more focus, is the idea of object proliferation. Object proliferation. Now, let me give you a brief history of objects to put you in the picture. The first man-made objects that we have are 3 million years old. These first objects are found in Africa, and they are very small. They are like hand axes and pounding tools and things like that, with a minimal of modification to them, very minimally modified. And as an archaeologist, I happen to study this in great detail, the kind of generation of tool making. And what progressively begins to happen after another 1.5 million years of no new and improved models, can you imagine, any the car industry with the same models for 1.5 million years. The first innovation is symmetry. That's the first innovation in toolmaking, is the idea of some degree of symmetry. And then you begin to get into chipping and flaking as sharpening, and gradually you finally begin into what we call microgeometry tools. You get into very, very small tools that are very precise, and the kind of needlepoint stuff, and very, very finely made things about 30, 40,000 years ago. And it's about 30 or 40,000 years ago, again, where you begin to generate the first symbolic objects. That's where you go from functional to symbolic objects. And when you make this leap, language is, you know, afoot, as soon as you begin to get symbolic objects. And with symbolic objects and language, everything begins to escalate. Because in the scenario of objects, as it were, what begins to happen is, roughly, we have the Neolithic Revolution, which is about 9,000-10,000 BC. Some people put it a few thousand years earlier or later, but it's irrelevant. In the Neolithic Revolution, essentially, before we were hunter-gatherers, we were nomads. We followed herds of different animals, the caribou and the deer and the bison and the mammoth. We followed the seasonal growth of plants to wherever they occurred. We followed nature, and we did not own nature. Now, what gradually began to happen in the Neolithic Revolution, someone had a bright idea, and that is that we could domesticate crops and animals. We did not have to follow. We could take something and plant it. And with this planting, we could stay in one place. We would not be at the kind of whims of this grand seasonal variation. And our animals, we could domesticate animals. That is to say, we did not have to go hunting all the time. We would begin to domesticate cows and keep them in pens, and sheep and goats and things like that would begin to occur. And, you know, it's a wonderful invention for many people, the idea of stopping this nomadic life. Others were not so sure that this was a great idea, because there was a great virtue in the nomadic life in many ways as well. But history rolled on, and what began to happen is, as you begin to settle and to nucleate, you began to generate objects for the first time in a different scale than just hand axes and cutting tools, just the bare essential tools. You began to make tools, more permanent holding tools now. Instead of transporting water in ostrich eggs that were biodegradable in a very neat sense, you would begin to make longer lasting objects of clays and potteries. And in other words, the half-life of your objects would begin to increase. The idea of permanent objects, instead of kind of a throwaway culture, began to accrete. And as these objects began to accrete, you began to gradually through the years to make decorations on them and art on the objects. And this made the objects more valuable, quote unquote, whatever that meant at the time. And these objects had the very strange effect on people's minds, as they acted like an attractor matrix for the human mind, on which to see even further possibilities for the proliferation of even more objects. That is to say, once you made a bowl, well, we can make a better bowl, and a bowl with a spout, and then a bowl with a this on it, and one with greater capacity, and then so on and so forth. Object proliferation began to form. It began to be a mirror to which the mind could say, well, we've done this, but we can do this better. Before, you extracted from nature, now you were on this kind of reflection process. So that was one dynamic that began to occur, object proliferation and the generation of even more objects. Now, I should say at a footnote right now, before I go on with the scenario, the average home has in it today 300,000 objects in it. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. And that means that you have to deal with the location and function and care of all these objects. So therefore, a lot of your mental activity is tied into this object array environment. Okay? Now, what happens, let's go back to the Neolithic for a moment. You see, then we have very few objects. It's gone from a few pots and bowls and a few digging sticks and spears and what have you and furs and beads and things like that to 300,000. I mean, the proliferation that has to go with that, you see, the concomitant proliferation is the secret of this process. Is when you begin to generate objects, you have to have a concomitant and corresponding memory for every object that you own, whether it's online or not. It is. The point is that we don't keep the 300,000 memory online all the time. It's we chunk things. We say it's in the garage, it's in the bedroom, it's in the den, it's in the kitchen. We have a chunking by spatial kind of labeling. But on the whole, what happens is, as soon as you have an object, you have to have a memory of that object. Otherwise, the object is useless to you. You don't know where you put it, and therefore you can't use it. So you have to have some corresponding memory. Now, in terms of ownership, what begins to happen is very interesting. As soon as you begin to have this object proliferation, you begin to have the generation of a noun. A linguistic noun has to come into being for the generation of that object. This is a spear thrower. This is, you know, my water bowl. This is my fur to keep me warm. This is my talisman. Whatever it is, you have to have a corresponding noun for every object that is generated. Now, with this kind of generation of noun, the converse of this, most curious thing begins to happen is the generation of pronouns N begins to occur. This is my object. This is your object. This is his object. This is their object. When you were in nature, there was no pronouns. There was just this vast, undifferentiated participation mystique. No differentiation of subject and object. Therefore, no pronoun. So pronouns are generated from nouns, and nouns are generated from objects. So you get this linguistic matrix beginning to occur. And it occurs in this kind of unconscious proliferation. Again, language is virus. Now, what begins to happen is, again, the possibility of runaway systems. And as Morris Berman, a cultural historian, pointed out recently, you begin to get what he calls commodity fetishism. The idea that in the old days when objects, for example, certain totemic things in the Indian Northwest were made, they were meant to degenerate with weather after they were made. The masks and the things like that were left to weather and disintegrate, to dissolve in the dissipative cycle back into nature. They arise, they abided, and they dissolve. They were not kept as objects of art, you see. What we have done is taken these objects and got into the abiding phase, memory wrongly interpreted, and we fixate there, and we keep that going. So you get this very kind of interesting scenario arising. Now, let's take a look at this in terms of the media, how this can be put to us in a very entertaining and insightful way. There was a film that was made, I don't know, maybe 7-8 years ago, something, I don't know, maybe it was more than that, 10 years ago, called The Gods Must Be Crazy. How many of you saw this film? I figured a lot of you would. I'll give you a brief recapitulation of this film because it's a wonderful teaching film. Basically, the scenario happens, there's an airplane flying over Africa, And two of the guys in it, one of them is drinking Coca-Cola. And he finishes the bottle, and he throws it out of the plane. They're over the middle of nowhere. He throws it out, and it lands near a Bushman hunting party, as chance would have it. And the Bushmen then see this bottle, and it is the introduction of a new and novel object into the culture. When this object comes in, first it is met with wonder and awe, and the multifarious uses of it are then discovered. First of all, you could put things in it as a container that was very durable. It was a wonderful container for water. Second of all, you could roll things out like a roller. Then you could blow in it and make wonderful sounds with it. Then you could, you know, all these objects were all these uses for the object were seen. But what began to happen is that everyone wanted to use it. All the pronoun thing began to arise as soon as this object was introduced. And what began to happen in this little world where there was peace and harmony was discord. Tremendous sense of discord. I want it, no. And fights began to break out over who was going to use this Coca-Cola bottle. Exactly.
This Coca-Cola.
This Coca-Cola had occurred. So the thought was, and this is brilliant, the Bushman wisdom still prevailed. They thought, the gods must be crazy to have given us this object. It causes havoc in this society. So one of them was given the task to take this Coca-Cola bottle to the edge of the world and get rid of it. Get this object out of here. We got enough objects. That's essentially what they were saying. Okay, so in a microcosm in this film is this wonderful teaching about how an object, a single object in this case, can take a very harmonically based culture and throw it out the window. Jung said, speaking of our current era, knowledge of the internal world of the psyche was eclipsed by the external world of objects. The very same insight. The more we got hooked on objects, the more that we began to lose the kind of internal world. Now, it's interesting that in terms of the very first writing ever discovered, it's a favorite kind of point I've come up archaeologically, is not some mystical writing about Mu or Lemuria or channeling or anything like that. The first writing ever discovered is a Sumerian tax receipt. Okay? It's 4500 BC, and it's a tax receipt. Because what it is saying is, you have dealt with these objects and we want to keep a record of them so that we can find out the karmic trajectory of this object. Now, this is what begins to happen with objects. Record keeping grows as an industry. For all, you have to keep a memory for every object. Record keeping grows in proportion to object proliferation. Today, the biggest industry on the face of the earth is record keeping. That's what computers do more than anything else, besides their creative uses. They do more than anything else is inventory. It's record keeping. And they're doing it, they're keeping track of objects and events connected with objects. The transactions and interactions and transformations of objects, that's what is being kept records of. So record keeping grows out of this proliferation of this object array. So, in a sense, you see, you get an extended mind, an unconscious extended mind is generated through this generation of objects. And what it begins to generate, then, is the idea of, shall we say, a left-brain memory. Now, a left-brain memory, you see, corresponds to the middle phase of the dissipative cycle. That is to say, the abiding phase of memory. Memory in the world that we can see. And this, again, is the realm where, if you overload it, memory wrongly interpreted begins to proliferate. Now, let's take a little bit, a closer look at this idea of the kind of the metaphysical arising of the way that we see the world. The density of objects in an environment creates a corresponding density of memory that you, through record keeping. And in turn, this density of memory generates the density of time. Temporal density is a function of memorial density, and memorial density is a function of object density. You will notice that those cultures that have the fewest objects live in the dream time. You look at the Australian Aborigines with their minimal object array, and you see that they live in a completely different time frame. They live in a dream time, the Bushmen, the same. As your object density, memorial density, temporal density occurs, it sets out this extended, unconscious array of time. Time is generated. And this generation of time, the density of time, has a further aspect to it, which is very interesting. Because of the transactions and accounting for all these objects, the emphasis is placed on on short-term memory, because there are more objects and more transactions and interactions. Therefore, the short-term memory, where did I put this and what did I do with this and what happened here, because there are more things, your short-term memory has to be more active. And your short-term memory has to be more active also in terms of crisis situations. Whenever you have a potential crisis going on, which is now pretty much nonstop in the world at large. So the short-term memory has to keep track of everything. And again, the short-term memory takes place in this middle phase. Your short-term memory has to be more active also in terms of crisis situations. Whenever you have a potential crisis going on, which is now pretty much nonstop in the world at large. So the short-term memory has to keep track of everything. And again, the short-term memory takes place in this middle phase of memory abiding, in this middle phase. And this means that memory arising and memory dissolving. This is right brain memory. This gets left out. And this means that far memory, memory of past lives, that's where the Schlitzadze comes in. You only go around once in life. Well, that's smack in the abiding phase of the dissipative cycle again, you see. If object proliferation, short-term memory in terms of, I've looked at memory, I've read so much material on memory for the past 10 years on the experimental psychology aspects of memory, just to see what's in these people's minds. They're looking at smaller and smaller increments of memory. Short-term memory is like really where it's at for many people. Short-term memory is like a paradigm in itself. It's like corresponding to the search for the atom as the lowest common denominator in the physical world. Short-term memory is the lowest common denominator in the memorial world. You look for the accuracy and the way that short-term memory works as a kind of a hypothesis that contributes to reality. Now, I should say as a footnote to that, the idea of what is known in the memory trade as STML, short-term memory loss, which is one of the signal attributes of altered states. This is one of the first things that happens to memory is short-term memory loss. Now, many people in the investigation of memory look at the real traditionalists in memory research look at short-term memory loss as pathological. You lose you're losing your mind if you lose your short-term memory. Watch out. Keep control. Stay in the abiding phase where it's safe. Let's accumulate some, let's stay in control. It's all that kind of thing. Don't let go. Whatever you do, don't let go of your memory or you will just melt. You'll evaporate. But the real secret is that that's the ploy. Stay with memory because memory is control. The point, that's how the CIA looks at it, and all intelligence agencies, they look at memory as control. But the fact, the secret is, of the perennial philosophies, that if you die to yourself, that if you unknow, learn the art of unknowing, that if you learn the art in Tibetan, which is called Chan Mei, which is non-memory, what happens then is that you do not lose your mind. Actually, you come into what Jill was talking about yesterday, primordial mind or nature of mind. This has no pronouns, you see. This has no hooks of personality to it. So Memory is used as a control device. That's why when you take classes at school, you're asked to regurgitate in early school rote mnemonic. Because, see, this is a way of hooking you into control and predictability. It's kind of, give me back what I gave you now. Give that right back. No, nothing new. Just give that right back to me. This is, you will get the highest marks on your test for regurgitation. So the idea of short-term memory loss as a gateway, it is actually a gateway into a different dimension, the dimension of God, the dimension of the overmind, of the over-self, whatever you want to call it, Atman, Brahman, it doesn't matter. It's different spelling for the same phenomena. The same phenomena is primordial mind. It really doesn't matter what you call it. But if you control short-term memory as a kind of a sphincter and you don't let anyone through that or yourself through it, you're locked in this abiding phase. When you go into through the rabbit hole, as it were, of short-term memory, through short-term memory loss, but you've got to go through it with awareness. If you go through it unconscious, you're finished. I mean, you're drunk, you're stoned, you can kill yourself in that form. You have no awareness, you have no clarity. But if you go through with awareness or clarity, that is the entrance to, the two phases of the dissipative cycle that are neglected, the arising and the dissolving aspects. You begin to see the entire dissipative nature of the mind. Now, one other thing about the objects here is that if you stay on the object level, you see, objects fixate attention. They fixate attention. And they generate kind of reactive automatic mind, that is, memory wrongly interpreted. So you fixate or you crystallize attention through your objects. This is my Mercedes, and I'm going to put an alarm system on it. No one's going to get this, and people begin to build up a paranoia about their valuable objects. You see, they become object hooked in that sense. Another aspect of this, in terms of our particular time, is that people tend to get into hoarding this time in this age that we live. These 300,000 objects, we have become temporal pack rats, in a sense. We are hoarding all these objects in a sense. We don't need all these objects, you know, all these 300,000 objects. We hoard them, and one of the reasons that we hoard them from a psychoanalytic point of view is that we think that these will be a buffer between us and death, between us and extinction. That if we hoard things, that they are a substitute for living time, these objects. And compulsive hoarding, and also a lot of people hoard when they get older, actually is a representative of trying to stave off death. The people who are very rich often accumulate tremendous arrays of things, not just for pleasure, but to actually keep the idea of extinction at bay. Now, if we look at objects from another point of view, that is to say, from the one point is, shall we say, the participation, the mystical participation, that is to say, when there's no difference between subject and object, in primitive societies, participation mystique versus the idea of the Buddhist or tantric teachings of detachment from objects. And I want to go into that for a moment. We have a very interesting kind of what Ken Wilber calls the pre-trans fallacy. You begin to separate two things which look the same, but they're really not. In the participation mystique, there's a kind of fusion of subject and object. In the Zen tradition, in the Eastern kind of sense, you are taught to detach yourself from objects, not buying their whole, seeing them as they are, but not becoming totally involved with them. And there's a subtle difference in this. As Hui Neng, the sixth patriarch, Zen patriarch, said, not to be defiled by external objects. This is to be one with the unconscious, and that's capital U. It's conscious, unconscious, he means there. That is to be detached from objects so they are present in consciousness. When all thoughts are discarded, consciousness is cleared off from all its defilements. So on one hand you have this fusion of subject and object, on the other one you have detachment like this, not getting attached to objects, okay? Now, there are some similarities between these two states. In the participation mystique, you may not become attached, but you don't consciously become detached. There's a subtle difference. Now, if we go on with this a little bit, it becomes interesting, because what Jung refers to is this, in the Zen tradition, this epistemological detachment. The translation for it of Hui Meng, of this unconscious, is the word Wu Nian. And Wu means no, and Nian means literally, it has several nuances to it. It means no memory or no habit patterns. It's most traditionally translated as no memory. So Wu Nian means no memory. Now, in other words, unconscious with a capital U, or conscious unconscious, means a state of no memory. But what this no memory is, and it's very important, is that it is a temporary suspension. It is not an obliteration of memory, non-memory. Non-memory is what Lung Changpa, one of the great masters of Tibetan Vajrayana thought, said, the spontaneous wizardry of the mind takes place out of emptiness or out of non-memory, the spontaneous wizardry. And again, the obvious, by the very terms that he uses, akin to shamanism, right there with the term wizardry. Non-memory is something that, you see, a computer is very interesting. A computer cannot unknow. This is a very important thing. It cannot go into the unknowing mode. If you clear a computer's memory, it's no temporary suspension. That's it. The little I know about computers, if you wipe the disk clean, that's it. You don't just say, okay, forget this, and then see what happens. This is a uniquely human function, the ability to suspend and then see what happens. Now, non-memory, you see, it shouldn't be cultivated for itself. It should be cultivated in conjunction with memory. That is to say, just because you've given up the abiding cycle and looked at the arising and dissolving, that's to substitute one thing for another. You need the whole cycle. The middle phase is conservation of memory. The others are the arising and dissolution of memory. So for memory to be its highest form, you have to have conservation and dissolution. You need the dance between non-memory and memory. It's like saying the left brain is bad. That's ridiculous. The left brain has a vital function. It's what enables us to communicate and to exist in this world in many ways and to make advances. But it's where we become fixated at one aspect of the dissipative cycle that amnesia sets in, and then a runaway system begins and we go out of control. That's the dynamic of it. So this non-memory, we have to learn how to look at it, to oscillate it. And in sitting practice, one of the most valuable things that I have learned from my altered states is the oscillation of memory and non-memory, the oscillation of attention and the release of attention, and realizing, and I always see them in an infinity cycle. I always see them in this form like this. I don't know why, my mind always takes it to this. Just this dance like this, because it moves to like memory, and then it shifts the dissipative cycle, and it shifts. And this figure eight, actually, that it occurs, eight is called the Lemnis gate in mathematics, and eight actually is very interesting. This is a footnote. Eight is the number of Isis, the goddess, and eight, the goddess is the great, as it were, the primordial mind. The last thing about objects that I would like to introduce now is that, again, objects in themselves are not negative at all. It is our reference to them that it is this unconscious mental mass, this linguistic flux, invisible flux, that makes them what they are or aren't. You see, because there's a tremendous tradition in my research and memory, I was astonished to find, I looked under the folk tales concerned with memory, there is a tremendous array of folk tales concerned with magical objects that restore memory. There is the magical stone, the magical drink, the magical feather, the magical flower, the magical kiss, the magical, you know, footstool. There are things which actually are encoded as awakeners in the environment. And this idea of awakening in the environment is a very interesting one. What it pertains to is the idea of the conscious impregnation of the environment, of mind, specifically to awaken people in future states when they go by or interact with this object. And to use Rupert's framework, this is the setting up of a morphic framework around an object. If you take an object and you sit with it and you meditate it and you sleep with it and you dream with it and you use it in ritual, it begins to absorb. In psychometry, we see that these vibrations are absorbed. Every object we have absorbs some of our field. That's why psychometrists can take a ring or a belt in a very unusual way. One of the ways this is done, for example, in the Gurdjieff tradition, is you take a place or an object, and a good thing that I use in many of the classes that I've taught is you take a doorway, and you say to your class or those that people that you're dealing with, every time you pass this doorway, you should wake up, be mindful. It's like the bell going off in the retreat, the meditation retreat. Every time you pass the doorway, you have a microsecond of increased awareness to that you are part of this universal flux and that you are not just an ego, any way you want to encode it, but a moment of heightened awareness when you pass this object. Then the art becomes to impregnate an environment with conscious objects. And then as you begin to impregnate your environment, you begin to set up an extended mind field in the environment which you react with when you go out into it. And this is why for the American Indian and the Taoist and all the other Aboriginal peoples, that their environment was a conscious environment, that Gaia was alive, and that when you went out, you didn't just see, you remembered. That's what the dream time was about. All these ancestors, the rainbow serpents and the great whales and all the totemic beings, you were reminded that you were part of this dream time, of Gaia, of this living entity. Anyhow, let's stop here. I've got another subject. Let's break for about, 10 minutes, but don't wander too far because I want to keep the rhythm, and we'll continue. Part two, meanwhile back at the source. I want to go on to another subject, a very valuable one that we should look at, and that is one of the counters to the state of kind of waking sleep or this runaway system, this memory wrongly interpreted. One of the principal counters to it is to develop something called cross-state retention. Cross-state retention. I've talked about this before, but I've done a lot of thinking about it kind of since that time. Now, cross-state retention, or CSR, is based on the idea that most of the time when we are in an altered state, whether it's psychomimetically induced or dream or emotional, when we go back to an ordinary state, we don't remember. There's a veil of forgetting between going from state to state. This is, Roland Fisher calls it state-bound experience. In classical memory parlance, it's called state-specific memory. That is to say, if you're one of the classic things, for example, in Sufi story is Nasruddin, he loses his key and while he's drunk, wakes up the next morning, can't find it, and he says, what am I going to do? And he says, well, I'll get drunk again. And he stumbles off into the bushes again and finds the key because he's in the same state. This is just an example by parable of the way that it works. Now, again, in the dissipative cycle, the abiding section, the center one, there's the arising, abiding, and dissolving. In the abiding cycle, that's where state-specific memory in current research is focused, in this area right here. You don't cross state. You don't look at the transition between arising and abiding, and between abiding and dissolving, and between dissolving and arising. You don't look at the transitions, you see, in contemporary memory research. You only look at this abiding phase, and some psychoanalytical history of early childhood. Now, cross-state retention is, most of us know, when we have dreams, unless it is an exceptionally vivid dream. When we wake up, we know that we have dreamed, but the dream disappears like the bubbles of a wave going out after they just go pop, 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 and it dissolves because it's like a different dimension. There are yogas of dream recall taught in the Tibetan tradition. There are yogas taught in African systems of shamanism that I know of for dream recall. There are many aspects of cross-state retention taught in many different esoteric traditions. In fact, I would say that cross-state retention is the essence of all shamanic and esoteric ways of thinking. At heart, for example, Eliade teaches that the shaman is the man who goes into the other realms, or the woman who goes into other realms, but he is able to bring it back. You see, this is what differentiates him from other beings. He's able to bring it back. Many people have altered state experiences and they're, wow, next morning, I really can't elaborate on quite what happened, but I know it was fantastic. It's what we call the limbic system flash. You know that it happened and you have a rush, but you can't elaborate it. Now, the idea of cross-state retention, first of all, is never taught to us in school. I want to bring this to a basic, everyday life. We're never taught any idea of cross-state retention. You're taught state-specific, regurgitative memory. You are not taught the idea of remembering from one. You're not even taught that you got other states, let alone remembering between them. Now, the idea of this kind of shamanic sense can be taught in many different ways. It can be taught in, for example, the idea of what is called holy reversals is one way in which cross-state retention is taught. For example, in the peyote ceremonies, when the Huichols go to the highlands, is it pronounced Wirakuta? When they go, there's a certain point in distance where everything must be reversed in terms of language and act and symbol. If you are right-handed, you do everything with the left hand. If this is your friend, you refer to him as your enemy. If you're walking along and it's a beautiful sunny day, you'll say, gee, isn't the moon lovely tonight? The reversals are a way of jarring the attention from fixated patterns. And this inculcates an unusual quality to the attention so that it is remembered differently because of the reversal. So this quality of reversal is done in many different traditions throughout the world. That's just one in particular. In fact, I recall one that Rupert told me about once, and that is the tradition of Holi in India. Isn't there a reversal between master and servant?
Yes.
That's rather interesting. And I think this probably arose not from just kind of some sense of equality, but from some sense of awakening. The name itself might have something to do with that. Now, if we look at another aspect of this cross-state retention, to operate it fully, it requires a notion of the entire dissipative cycle, how things arise, how they abide, and how they disappear. And a knowledge also that there is always, no matter what phase you're in, that apparently that primordial mind is there, no matter what phase is showing its face, whether it's the abiding phase or the dissolving or the arising. The primordial sense is always there. And if you have that sense, the idea of cross-state retention is vastly made much more easy. But in practical terms, really, let's get, you know, non-theoretical from practical terms, the best way for cross-state retention to work is the following. You see, attention in the modern world, because of all the objects that we've got in it, attention slides across the surface of the mind of objects. It just slides. We never go in deep. It slides across the surface of the world. Now, how do we counter that? Well, for one of the ways in the traditional schools, like in the Gurdjieff tradition, that is done, there's a tradition called self-remembering. And self-remembering literally means that You, just like in mindfulness, you take a moment, any moment. You take this moment, for example, and you make it special by investing it with an inordinate amount of intention. And you see, just in a footnote to this explanation, the sequence goes intention, attention, retention. If your intention, if your will is clear that you want to remember, you will pay attention, and therefore your retention will be clear. Intention, attention, retention. That's how it works. Now, if you want to raise consciousness by this cross-state retention manner, you take a moment, and it can be any moment, and you encode your all of your five senses response to that moment. In other words, you take 1 minute, like right now, you take a minute, and first of all, you look around you, and you don't try to encode everything. This is something I've learned. You look at a number of key objects, 3, 4, 5. The mind can only chunk 7 plus or minus 2 objects at a time. So don't try to chunk, say, more than 5 to 9 objects. You look around, say, at people. You see what they're wearing, just generally. Then you look at your what you're sitting on, and you feel it, and you see what is this texture feeling, like so. And then you do your smell, like I can smell tiger lily over here. And then you can look into the sense of taste, what kind of taste in your mouth, perhaps from breakfast or the coffee that you're just drinking or whatever it is. And what you stop for a moment and you hear the flies, you hear the birds, you hear the sound between, you encode that. And you begin to multi-sensory encode over a 1 minute period. And the way that it works in the phone, you begin to encode all of those things. And the way that it works is, the more things that you can encode a memory in sensorially, the easier it will be to recall the entire memory. That's really it in a nutshell. So, if you're able to have in these five sensory modes, it's very different than if you just saw someone, you only have a visual sensory mode to recall from. But you see, the senses reinforce each other. And if you can reinforce them by your attention, you're set. Now, after the 10 years I've been working on my memory thesis, I can put it down to a nutshell what it's all about. Memory is a function of attention. That's it. It's the whole thing. It's the name of the game. If you don't pay attention, you don't remember. It's that simple. It's that simple. And, of course, if you don't have an intention, you don't have an attention. So it's that intention, attention, retention is the memorial cycle. So what we do is we take that minute, and you have to know how to trigger yourself in that moment. I usually, when I give classes or something, do it in a way which is, do you want to say something? Okay. The sense of encoding is done by like a theme. For example, the theme of water is given. I'll say to a class, we're going to meet next Thursday, but next Tuesday, I would like you, or any time before that, any time that you see water in any form, be it rain or washing up liquid or flushing the toilet or taking a bath, any time you see water, I wanted to remind you to take a moment, one moment, and stretch it out and do that multisensory sensing. And then I'm going to ask you all to tell your story of that moment. I have them all tell stories. And of all these moments, and you get these, and see, what I'm about is slices of life. Every moment is special, but it's only special because of the attention invested in it. And I've had them, I mean, these housewives, I taught adult education in England for a while, and these housewives had said, well, I was washing the dishes, and I remember the water, and I looked around, and there was the full moon, and she just got excited, and, you know, and then my husband came home, and the dog barked, and, you know, and this little old moment became special. And many people did this. We did this with all kinds of things. All I'm saying is that this cross-state retention is developed by multi-sensorial attention within, say, a minute's framework. And you have to be able to trigger yourself. The point is, we're too lazy. We walk through the world, and we go like this, but we never just go like that. That is to say, you're walking by a beautiful flower. I mean, I do this all the time. And all of a sudden, it catches my attention, and I'll sit with it. I'll smell it, and I'll see the ground that is coming out. I'll let that be a cue. Anything can be a cue for you, and you go into that mode. Now, One of the other things about cross-state retention that I'd like to say, and this really relates to the theme of the extended mind, is the idea, first of all, just the idea of cross-state involves extension right in itself, right to begin with. The idea, there are two types of cross-state retention that I'd like to look at. And one of them is, it's purely associative, like this idea reminds me of this idea, reminds me of this idea, and it's this kind of glass bead game type of thinking, okay? And that is one type of cross-state retention, goes autocatalytic after all. It begins to breed more and more insights. It's like the opposite of memory wrongly interpreted. It's like memory rightly interpreted when it goes cross-state. Now, the other aspect of it is a Greek term called anamnesis. A-N-A-M-N-E-S-I-S, anamnesis, or any way you want to pronounce it. But anyhow, anamnesis has, again, two meanings to it. In the classical Greek sense, it means to be able to remember your karmic trajectory, as it were, your past lives back, like Pythagoras could remember when he was a butcher and a candlestick maker and a this and a that. Pythagoras was known for his ability to trace his karmic trajectory back, and this is the idea of anamnesis. It is used today in psychoanalysis when talking about the patient's past history. They talk about a patient's kind of psychoanalytic anamnesis. Tell me about your early childhood, that type of thing. But you see, at a certain point, anamnesis, just going back with I was a dishwasher and I was a princess and I was a channeler or whatever, an ice skater, this goes back and back and back. And after a while, see, Buddha's first realization, his parinirvana beneath the bow tree, when he became enlightened, it began when he started going back in his karmic trajectory. He went back 500 lives and he was a this and a king and a queen and a this and a this, and he was cruel and he was happy and he was delightful and he was sad. But what he saw in his great genius was not the fact that he could go back life to life to life to life to life, as it were. What he saw is that every one of these lives was, in a sense, an illusory pearl on the necklace of primordial mind. That is, every one of these lives, although appearing separate,